I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Well, how to describe Michael Chabon's exhilarating and sprawling new book, Moonglow, especially since he's sitting across from me and he calls it a faux memoir novel. But here goes. It's 1989. Michael Chabon is at his grandfather's bedside as he is dying and telling him stories and adventures from his life, things Chabon had never heard before. The book, really a family saga, moves back and forth in time from his grandfather's childhood home at 10th and Shunk in South Philly to the battlefields and horrors of World War II to life in post-war America. His grandfather is obsessed with rockets and has a temper. Chabon's grandmother is a refugee, the host of a late-night TV show named Nevermore, the Night Witch, who is haunted by the image of a skinless horse. She's a wounded woman with secrets. The book is about many things, including the stories and the lies we tell each other and ourselves. Michael Chabon writes in the preface, "In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to the facts, except when facts refuse to conform to memory, narrative purpose, or the truth as I prefer to understand it." Michael Chabon joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you back with us on this show.
Good to be here.
Oh, you're
Thanks,
such a
Marty.
Troublemaker.
I'm just, you know, trying to give fair warning.
Fair warning. Mm-hmm. And as a reader, my head sort of exploded because I think as a reader, you want to know, this is a memoir, mm-hmm. this is a novel, mm-hmm. and you're mixing the two. Not that memoir isn't sometimes made up.
No, I think that's part one of the things I'm trying to remind us all as readers is that any kind of narrative that purports to reconstruct events that happened any time in the past, and especially those that purport to reconstruct events that happened a long time ago, is suspect from the point of view of factuality. It's always going to be a version. And once you're talking about versions, you're talking about fiction.
Do you think we either wittingly or unwittingly just do make up stories about ourselves?
Yeah, I think both. I think we do both wittingly and unwittingly. And, you know, I think most people, when they set out to write a memoir, are trying, I just give them the benefit of the doubt. They're trying to be accurate. They're trying to be truthful. They're trying to reconstruct it to the best of their ability. But everything lies in that phrase, the best of their ability. And even the best of us can't remember verbatim conversations from 25 years ago.
Sure, or even maybe an hour ago.
No, right. I mean, in my case, I can't even remember 5 minutes ago.
But did you in any way think, oh, maybe I'll write a memoir about my family or my grandparents? Did that ever cross your mind?
No, never. I mean, I'm not interested in writing memoirs. I'm not especially interested in memoir as a genre, although some of my favorite books are memoirs. I love This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff and Stop Time by Frank Conroy and, you know, Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory. And I don't know if that's exactly a memoir, but anyway, there are memoirs I love, but as to sit down and write a memoir straight would never occur to me. No, I mean, this is a fiction. It's a work of fiction. It's very clearly labeled a novel.
Yes.
On the front.
Yes,
you know.
It is.
you know, you're always working from memory. You're always, at least I am, I'm always drawing on my own personal experiences, my own memories, stories that I've heard from people around me, from relatives. You know, and some of my novels have a lot of autobiographical material in
sure.
them. It's all fictionalized, and this is one is no different. It has a lot of autobiographical stuff in it.
Well, even as an interviewer, when I'm interviewing someone about their novel, I am looking for what I think are bits and pieces
sure.
of their life that, in a sense, trying to answer the question, why did this person write this book?
Mm-hmm. And I do that as a reader, too, and I think most of us do. And there is that slight kind of slightly prurient interest you take in a work of fiction that, you know, you're reading along and you see the main characters referred to as having, you know, a head of blonde curls. And then you look at the author photo and the author has a head of blonde curls and you think, huh, I wonder, like, how much of this is real? That's the, you know, that's an inevitable question that crosses a reader's mind, I think. And in this book, I tried to sort of, in anticipating that, then tried to have a little fun with it.
You dedicate this book to them.
Yeah.
And of course, I have to ask, who's them?
Well,
or does it matter?
This book has two dedications. One, there's sort of a dividing line for me where the novel begins, and that is at the half title page. Everything after the half title page is fiction. So what you find after the half title page is an author's note, and you find an epigraph, and the epigraph is ascribed to Wernher von Braun. But I will just say that attribution is suspect.
Oh, is it?
And then that dedication also to them falls on the novel side. So that is the memoirists, the fictional narrator's dedication of his memoir is to them. Preceding that, on the other side of the half title page, is a dedication that says to them seriously.
To them.
And that's me.
And that's you.
I mean my actual grandparents and their whole generation. Their whole generation in my family, their siblings, and their siblings' spouses, and also their whole generation among American Jews, and in some ways their whole generation among Americans as well. But specifically the real people, my actual grandfather, my actual grandmother, and their families who are not the characters in this book.
Were you actually at your grandfather's bedside as he was dying?
Yes.
And telling stories?
Yes.
That you had not heard about?
Yes, yeah. I mean, nothing. There are a few of the things he told me made their way into this novel, the ones I could remember, to be honest. You know, I wasn't taking notes. I was just sitting with him listening. And, you know, he told me his memory seemed to have been jogged by the painkillers he was on, or else just that he knew he wasn't going to be around much longer. And maybe he even knew this was going to be our last time together. So, he was remembering his own childhood, which was in New York City, not in Philadelphia, like the
not
grandfather in
chunk?
The book. No, that was my grandmother. My real grandmother grew up here. She was born here. She grew up in South Philly. And he was remembering my mother's childhood and her siblings. And then he had memories of me when I was little. You know, it was just but things that I thought I'd heard all of his stories. I heard new things I hadn't heard. And of course, then that made me think, you know, what else is in there that
sure.
that I've never heard before? And you start to have that feeling. And I was 24, 25 at the time. I don't know this person. Like, this is my grandfather. I loved my grandfather.
Did you? I was wondering about your relationship
yes,
with him.
He was in many ways, my parents divorced when I was 12 and my father moved to Pittsburgh and I lived in Maryland. And so I saw a lot less of my father after that. But my grandfather, my mother's father lived near us in Maryland in Silver Spring. And we saw them every single week. And so he became very much a much more important person in my life after my parents divorced, all through my teen years. And I mean, I had already was very fond of him, and it was very mutual, I think. But, he as much as I loved him, as much as I learned from him, and as much as I felt like I'd heard about his life at this age and at that moment, I realized, like, I don't know anything about him. I don't know any of the things about his life as a man, as a husband. It's all still inside there, and I'm probably never going to hear it, and I didn't hear it. And so in a sense, that's one of the driving forces behind this book, is just to imagine the lives of the people that you feel right. that you had a chance to know and you didn't.
Well, the grandfather, or your grandfather mm-hmm. in this book, because he's called my grandfather, mm-hmm. Loves rockets.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a hellion, a rule breaker.
Yeah.
Difficult. He's a bad boy.
Yeah.
And a bad, not a bad man like a bad man, mm-hmm. but he's
a rule
breaker.
He gets into trouble.
He does get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. He struggles all of his life until he's in his late 30s, early 40s, and is finally sent to prison. It's not a spoiler. It happens all in the first few pages of the book. But
right.
until he's sent to prison, and even when he's in prison, he's tested. He's not able to control himself at moments where he would be better served by controlling himself. And it's only that experience of finally going to prison that he emerges from that experience sort of resolved never to get into trouble again. And that decision ends up, it's best for him, but it also ends up costing him something very dear toward the end of his life, where he has an opportunity to sort of do one last bad thing, and passing up that opportunity is quite painful for him.
Do you think of yourself as a good boy?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
no.
You are? You're
no,
a good boy?
I mean,
you're
the
good?
You know, the thing for me, like, this is, to me, it's a novel and it's a fake memoir, but it's it's also an imaginary autobiography in the sense that in creating and imagining the character of the grandfather, I think not consciously, but looking backward at it, I realized I was, at least in part, what I was doing was creating kind of a portrait of myself if I had allowed certain tendencies I think I have in me to take
to misbehave,
the upper hand. Yeah, and I was always a good boy, but I had to – it didn't come naturally. I learned how, and I learned eagerly and quickly because I guess I must have gotten some kind of reward from it. But if I hadn't had that initial reward that pushed me that way, I could easily have gone the other way. And also, this grandfather is a very taciturn, fairly antisocial man who prefers his own company. It is very hard to get to know, and you know, is shy, I think, also. And I have all those tendencies in me too, and I've just broken them down. I would just, you know, I forced myself out of those because it seemed like I had to. But I feel the strong appeal in being that way.
Well, I'm curious, since you said you got rewarded for being a good boy, if I can put it that way, was it to please others or perhaps please the adults in your life?
Absolutely. Starting
so they'd
with
be
your
proud
parents,
of you.
Yes, and your grandparents and then your teachers you know,
it's a lot of work, isn't it?
It is a lot of work, and especially if there is a part of you that wants to break things and ruin things and spoil things and you know, to quote Bruce Springsteen, what did he say when they said sit down, I stood up. Right. You know, like to have that impulse and squelch it. I mean, I don't regret it, but it's there. I can appreciate it. And I let all of that kind of flow into the character of the grandfather.
So the novel, the writing allows you to be perhaps this person that you weren't perhaps allowed to be
right.
as a kid?
And I mean, I think that's a big part of why, at least why I write novels, why I think a lot of writers write fiction. And it's certainly a big part of why I read fiction. And I mean, for me, I think the beauty, the perfection of the novel, of fiction generally, is that it gives you the illusion, at least while you're reading, of being someone else, of living someone else's life, and of being finally able to escape the prison of your own consciousness, of your own mind. You're trapped inside yourself your whole life. You never have access to the people around you completely, only what you can sort of glean or they allow you to give. And that itself is a version. It's a fiction so frequently. It's a presentation. And it's only within reading the pages of a novel that you get that. At least you feel almost what it might be like to be somebody else.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I actually want to have you read a section from your book. Michael Chabon is our guest. His new book is called Moon Glow. We've been talking about the creation of the novel and some of the true and not true things that are part of this novel. And you can join our conversation. That phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Michael Chabon about his new novel called Moon Glow. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning writer, and among his other books, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Well, let's talk about the grandmother that you write about in this novel. She's a refugee from France, at least as we are led to believe. She comes to the United States. She has a young child with her. Mm-hmm. She meets your grandfather at casino night
yes.
at the synagogue?
Yeah, Monte Carlo night.
Monte Carlo
yes,
night.
Yes, in Baltimore in 1947.
And his fly is down, and she zips it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that tells you a lot about this woman, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also it tells you about him, too, because the reason his fly is down is because he's so unhappy at being at this function that he has his hands just stuffed so deeply into his pockets, and there's so much force in this gesture that it actually pulls open the fly of his pants, and he's not aware of it. Yeah, and then it's love at first sight, yeah. Certainly for him, as far as we ever hear, it was for her as well. And runs into her by chance once. He sees her, and then he figures out, he follows her home, and then he sees where she lives, and then one night he sort of drives by kind of piningly looking up at her windows, and then their whole meeting has been part of this elaborate plan among the sisterhood of the congregation where the grandfather's brother, Uncle Ray is the character's name, is a rabbi. He's a new young rabbi. And the sisterhood of this congregation are desperately plotting to marry the rabbi to this beautiful available widow who's very refined and talented and multilingual and so on. Instead, the grandfather kind of falls into the trap, and he's the one who snares her, and at the same time, and so he's been invited almost accidentally to this dinner that's right. supposed to be a setup to again trying to get the rabbi with the woman, and the rabbi, Uncle Ray, sensing it's a trap, brings his brother along, and I'm going to read to you this part where they kind of the grandmother and grandfather are get themselves alone in a sense for a moment. And he says, "I like you." "I like you too." She said it in half a second and then added less than half a second later, "I have a little girl. Did you know this?" "Right," my grandfather said, caught off guard. So there were two of them. Two. Who would need saving. "How old?" "4 years, 5 years in September." "And you're the father?" "I murdered him." When she saw my grandfather's face, she burst out laughing, then covered her mouth with her hand. She started to choke on the smoke of her cigarette. "No, I'm sorry." At first, she kept on laughing, but as the coughing fit persisted, it seemed maybe she had started to cry. My grandfather couldn't tell. She held her breath, let it out. She pulled herself together. "That was a joke, but not funny, so why I was laughing?" That was a tough one to answer. My grandfather let it pass. She stubbed out the cigarette in a pot on the étagère that held dirt and a withered stalk. "The father is dead," she said, "in the war." She walked over to the casement window my grandfather had opened and put her face through into the cold air. She looked up at the moon, a day or two past its first quarter. She was convulsed by another shudder, then another. She was definitely crying now, and probably cold as hell. He slung the fur coat over one of the wicker chairs. He took off his blazer. It was the same one he had borrowed from his brother to wear tonight in Monte Carlo. He lowered the blazer over her shoulders. She leaned into it as if it were a stream of hot water from a shower head. She kept on leaning backward until she fell against him. He felt the shock of contact. The weight of her against his chest felt like something she had decided to entrust to him. He wanted badly, wanted only, to be worthy of that trust, though apparently his penis stirring had its own ideas on the subject. "I want to fly to the moon too," she said. "Take me with you." "Sure thing," my grandfather said. "I'll figure it out."
Love that. Michael Chabon reading from his new novel called Moon Glow. It's a difficult but intense love affair that they have.
Yes.
And you also, we hear about your grandfather's penis.
Yes.
You also have
a popular subject in literature, of course.
Of course,
going back
of
to
course.
Homer.
But you do have several short scenes, but scenes where your grandparents, mm-hmm. as you write about them, are making love,
right.
are having sex,
right.
And you know, it's hard enough, I think, for children to imagine their parents being sexual mm-hmm. with each other,
mm-hmm.
but then a grandson imagining his grandparents having sex
mm-hmm.
seems like a whole other can of worms.
I will say it was definitely an odd sensation. You know, I mean, more than anything else, I think it was just writing descriptive phrases of the woman in question's body in this sexual moment and having that woman be called my grandmother and just using that those two words and putting them into this particular context. And of course, while this book does have scenes of the grandfather later toward the end of his life when he's an old man in sexual situations. And that was another whole separate kind of thing. These are when they're still young people. And yet I'm still calling them my grandfather and my grandmother. And that was an odd sensation. But in the very oddness of it was an immediate confirmation to me that it was the right thing to be. If, you know, that's that sense of like, this is odd and strange and unusual. Therefore, I must do it. It was just clear to me.
But it has to be true. I mean, people have sex.
Exactly. I mean, by definition,
it's not like you're making that
one's
up.
Grandparents had sex, because otherwise one would not be sitting here. So,
exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, and yet, and I mean, that's part of this thing I'm talking about, the way that we think, you know, we think there is a tendency, I think, to caricature our parents to a degree, but to a much lesser degree than we do it with our grandparents. And our grandparents frequently, no matter how, whether we adore them or whether we despise them, we caricature them and we reduce them to this set of a finite set, usually a very small set of their sort of most salient characteristics or their most obvious characteristics. And, you know, so you have your, you know, my wife's grandmother, you know, we used to just laugh. Because she would constantly, she lived in Florida, we lived in California, and she would watch the Weather Channel all the time, like obsessively. And whenever there was, you know, any kind of meteorological disturbance or, you know, wildfire, if we live up in Berkeley, if there were wildfires raging out of control down in LA, you know, she'd call and say, "Are you okay?" You know, and the El Nino, you know, would strike terror into her heart. And so, but that was, I mean, she was an incredible woman who, you know, escaped from Russia with her mother when she was 5 years old and put herself through City College of New York in the 1930s, and at a time when very few women did that. And
this is my wife's grandmother.
Gotcha. You know, I mean, she was such an amazing, remarkable woman. And, you know, I did know some of that about her. I wanted to know that about her. But at the same time, when we talked about her, she was just these like five or six things that, you know. And it's nothing wrong. I mean, it's inevitable. It's natural. That's what we do. But it's through doing things like, say, imagining your grandparents having sex that's where you start to push yourself into this territory that we are not accustomed to going to, which is that they were human beings.
Well, and Mike, the
narrator.
The narrator. Mm-hmm. I'm all tongue-tied here. He has a really close relationship with his grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
At one point he says to her, "Are you a witch?" And she says back to him, "Not anymore." Which again, I loved. I mean, and she is the host of this TV show.
Yes, like an early TV program, a live TV program in Baltimore in the very earliest days of television, kind of filling up airtime as a kind of proto Vampira, you know, ghost host. She doesn't show movies. They didn't have movies to show at this era in television's history, but so she reads aloud from horror stories and ghost stories in this guise as Nevermore the Night Witch.
And she has puppets, and her grandson, he's afraid of these puppets.
Yeah. Do you
remember being afraid of things like puppets?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I had these, my parents went to Mexico when I was a kid. We lived in Arizona, so they must have gone just across the border. They brought back these puppets, and one was like a man with the black sort of mariachi uniform and a sombrero, and the other was sort of a señorita and with a mantilla, and they had these carved wooden faces with these rosy cheeks and these dead eyes that were still lustrous even though they were dead. And they hung, my parents, you know, they hung these on my wall. I was 3 years old. Nobody asked me if I wanted these marionettes hung on the wall, and they terrified me. Mm-hmm. Until we moved, and then they went into some packing box and they never reappeared again. I don't know what became of them.
So here they are in
novel,
right?
They come out. Well, there was another set of puppets that my actual grandparents had in their attic that had been brought back by someone from a trip to France. And these puppets were also terrifying. There's something about those old style carved wooden faces that the puppets also had that just really frightened me as a child.
I do want to have you read one more section from the book,
sure.
And this is about the grand. It's the first,
Right.
That guy, yes. I have all my post-its in there. The grandmother is haunted by this image of a skinless horse.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a hallucination. It's a sometimes auditory hallucination and sometimes visual and auditory hallucination of a of something that we presumably she refers to as the skinless horse, and that's how we always hear about it.
Just that first paragraph.
Yeah. So for a while after my grandfather got out of jail, the skinless horse appeared content merely to stalk my grandmother. When her daughter or husband happened to be around, and my grandfather, out of work and facing trial, happened to be around a lot, she drowned its nickering in a flood of chit-chat and palaver. When she found herself alone in the house, she had a record of Highland reels and marches that she played very loud because, for unknown reasons, the sound of bagpipes kept the creature at bay. At all times, alone or in company, she fought to avert her face from windows that overlooked the hickory tree. When her strength failed, the skinless horse would be there, sitting on one of the lower branches, baring its square teeth, stroking its enormous blood-red penis.
Mm. Again, from my perspective, a horse with its skin mm-hmm. is one of the most beautiful creatures. Mm-hmm. And to watch a horse canter across a field mm-hmm. is just, it is a marvel, a thing of beauty. Mm-hmm. But a skinless horse is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, there's something, there's a horse, there's a, another horse in this book. I mean, there are a few horses, and one of them is a beautiful horse. It's a thoroughbred in a meadow, you know, not far from here in Philadelphia, at a racetrack, a nearby a horse farm near a racetrack. And I try to describe some of that incredible grace and the way the light flows across the coat of a horse when it's moving as a kind of counterpart to the skinless horse. But the, even so, to me, there's something uncanny about horses. There's of all the domesticated animals, they're the least domesticated to me. They're the ones that still have some kind of something a wildness.
Wild. Untamed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. An untamed quality. And that makes them, you know, I love horses and I like to be around them and I like to ride them, but they also frighten me too.
You do use, as I understand it, used images, pictures, and things to help you tell this story. I'm looking at one. It's a horse's head,
a skull
actually.
Right.
You need visuals. I mean, visuals help you as a writer.
Well, I've always, from the beginning, you know, when you're working on a novel, you encounter images. Sometimes through research, you're doing research, and you know, if I was working on a novel that was supposed to be my second novel, and this was squarely in the pre-internet era, and one element of it had to do with the temple in Jerusalem and sort of these dreamed of attempts to rebuild the temple to create a third temple, and I found this article in Newsweek or Time magazine about people who are trying to do that, and it had images of the scale models that they were building, and I cut those out and you know, I stuck them to a bulletin board. So in that era, it would be like that, or else you're in a museum and you see a painting and it somehow reminds you of something you're working on, and you go buy the postcard in the gift shop, and you know, I would stick things, and I still do that, by the way. I do have a bulletin board, and I do collect and amass images that way still, but primarily nowadays it's through the internet, and it's in the course of researching and, you know, Wikipedia. I need to describe a horse's skull, so I Google horse skull, you know, and image search, and I get all these incredible photos of horses' skulls, and you know, I needed a horse skull for a certain moment in the story where the mother is frightened by a horse skull that her mother has somehow acquired, the grandmother has somehow acquired. But then when I was looking at these pictures, I mean, they're just, skulls are always interesting to look at, but there's something, certain animals' skulls look, you could sort of guess what animal it was, and they look like the animal, but a horse skull, it looks, it's really evil looking, really sinister, and it has a smile on both sides of its face.
Yeah, you can see the
two smiles. And it, you know, it's weird. It's just like elephant skulls look that they don't, they look like the skull of a cyclops. They have that big hole in the middle of the face as if there was one big eye right in the center. And there's something about a horse skull too, that it has these horrible snapping turtle kind of front teeth that look like it must have had a beak.
We're almost up in a break here, but one of the reviewers of your new novel described you as a writer, a graphic novelist who writes in prose. Does that fit what that experience is like for you?
Well, I mean, I do, to the extent that I do try to create a picture, I really want the reader to see what I'm seeing. And I see it in my mind's eye, and then I try to capture that in language, and then you hope this magical process happens where those little marks on the page or the pixels on the screen transfer into, it's like you know, some old-fashioned thing like faxing or something like that, right? Where you have a physical thing that gets turned into information that gets turned into a physical thing at the other side. You know, so to that extent, but I mean, there was a certain, I know that I saw that review, and there was a little bit of an implication of like sort of exaggeration or sort of a cartoonish quality or something, a heightened reality. And, you know, I accept that may read that way, at least to some readers. But from my point of view, I'm trying to be as accurate as I possibly can.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Michael Chabon is our guest. His new book is called Moonglow. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Michael Chabon about his new book, Moonglow, and it involves many things: World War II, the Holocaust, South Philly, rockets, lies, love, secrets, snake hunters, the haunting image of a skinless horse, all told in Chabon's vivid prose. 1-888-477-9499, the number to join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Richard, he says, if a writer heavily uses others' real life experience, to what extent and in what ways must the writer respect the real life experience, even in a work of fiction? What duties does the writer owe to the real person that he or she has made use of?
I'm tempted to say none whatsoever, but that might sound too flip, and it might imply that a kind of callousness that I don't feel. But I mean, a work of fiction is a work of fiction. If you are fictionalizing, then it really doesn't matter what aspects of the characters you're creating might have been derived from or drawn from real life people, because you're putting them to fictional use, and presumably they're not emerging. I mean, it's only ever your point of view on the person to begin with. You know, I mean, I think when it comes to my children, there's a difference. So, you know,
you're more protective.
Yeah, when it comes to your parents, I mean, what I always say is, like, with one's parents, with a writer's parents, it serves them right for raising a writer. It's their fault.
That's,
you know,
convenient.
They should have known better. But now I'm, you know, I'm a parent too, and,
sure,
and I will have to hold myself to that. Should any of my kids, you know, should I appear in some kind of fictionalized form in something that one of my kids writes? But with my children, you know. I wrote a couple of, when we're talking about fiction, when we're talking about nonfiction, if I'm going to write a nonfiction piece about one of my kids, I check with them. I clear it with them. You know, I make sure it's okay. I would never, you know, do that. I would never write and not check with them first. I have written a little bit here and there. My kids have sort of made their way in various fictionalized forms into some of my stories, and I'm so glad glad that I have those now. Like, I've written, there's a couple of short stories, one that I wrote where I used some of my now 22-year-old daughter's behaviors at age two to create a little 2-year-old girl character in a story. And if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't remember them anymore. They were these little passing phrases. It's like a snapshot of her at that moment, and they're frozen now in that story. And everything else that she did at that time, I've completely forgotten. Most of it's gone. The problem with this is if you go around worrying all the time about what you can say or can't say, or asking people for permission, or worrying about them recognizing themselves, it's a mug's game, because more than half the time, it is fiction. People don't recognize themselves at all. I've had people who I've based things on that don't have the faintest idea, including my wife. And
who's also a writer,
I should say. Yes, right. And then I've had people, the opposite happen, where people who I'm not thinking of, or I don't even know in some cases, think I've modeled a character after them. And not only, on top of all of that is, the things you think might be offensive to people aren't. And then something you say that seems perfectly innocuous, that it would never occur to you in a million years to get permission or check and make sure, turns out for whatever reason that's a sore point and that's a sensitive thing. So,
well, you raise your children, so let me quote a couple of things. And again, I'm going to BuzzFeed now, this was a profile of you and of your wife, I should say. What the writer says is, what Chabon's fiction is obsessed with are hapless fathers, deadbeat fathers, cheating fathers, and mostly all absent fathers. And then goes on to quote you to say that basically you didn't want to be that kind of father. You mm-hmm. wanted to be as involved in their lives as your wife right. was, or perhaps as a mother could be. Mm-hmm. And you had a recent piece in GQ about going to Fashion Week with your son. Mm-hmm. I think he's 13 years old.
Yeah.
My son, the prince of fashion.
By the way, I did not title the piece. So
okay.
I don't think of my son as the prince of fashion. No, but he is. He's definitely a little fashionista.
He
loves clothes, men's clothes.
Well, let me just quote. I took my son to Paris Fashion Week, and all I got was a profound understanding of who he is, what he wants to do with his life, and how it feels to watch a grown man stride down a runway wearing shaggy yellow Muppet pants. But I like the part where this is a child I'm assuming you've lived with for 13 years, mm-hmm. but you really saw who he was.
Well, I mean, he...
Or perhaps a part of him you didn't know as intimately?
No, it was that part... It was not that so much as something about him that I knew and I had seen, but I hadn't understood. And it wasn't until this experience of taking him to Men's Fashion Week in Paris for GQ that I at least began to understand it and to look at it. I kept looking at his interest in clothes and fashion as an interest in clothes and fashion. And then we went off to Fashion Week, and it ought to have just sort of furthered that sense I had that that's what it was. But what I ended up realizing, because of the way that he responded to it and the way that he, what I saw was meaningful to him about it, was that he was among people who loved something, the same thing that he loved as much as he loved it, and that he felt comfortable and he felt like himself.
I think you called it a tribe, right?
Yeah, it's his people. And your family are your people. Your family, that's your tribe to a point. And for a lot of us, that point is not nowhere close to all the way to the center of who we are. And a lot of us have to find our people outside of our families. We have to either create our own families or sort of families of choice, or we become caught up in something like a love of beautiful clothing that does give us a place to be and feel that we are accepted and understood in a way that maybe our families never quite fully do understand or even accept us.
Do you feel like you're a tribe of writers?
In my family?
Well, I mean, I know.
Or is my tribe writers?
Is it Jewish writers? Or
my tribe, I feel like I was just talking about this with my wife, that, I really didn't have a tribe.
There's some advantages to that,
aren't
there?
Until I made one.
Oh,
and
until
it's
you
sort
made
of
one.
Like my, I think, you know, have my children and my family became my tribe in a way that I had never really quite felt before. Not the family I was born into, but the one that my wife and I created together, which is beautiful, and it's been a wonderful experience for me. It's also a little bit melancholy, too, because now they're my oldest is 22 and the next one's 19, and they're growing up and they're going out in the world and they're finding their own people. And they're, you know, inevitably it's my tribe's leaving me, you know,
getting smaller,
I have to
right?
Somehow find another one.
Well, let me go back to your novel and also to some things you said earlier in the interview about your grandparents. I mean, oftentimes of that generation, they are called the greatest generation. Mm-hmm. But these are people, many of whom fought in World War II, mm-hmm. saw the horrors of war. Mm-hmm. Some, like the grandmother in this situation, has connections to the Holocaust, or mm-hmm. some are certainly Holocaust survivors. These people are dying. I mean, this is a generation that is disappearing.
I was just reading about the number of veterans who were involved in Pearl Harbor, and we just observed the anniversary, and it's just dwindling. I mean, of course, it's dwindling at this exponential rate now, and within a couple, 10 years, there will be almost none of them left. And the living eyewitness, either survivors or eyewitnesses as liberators or whatever it might have been to the Holocaust, to the camps and so on, are going fast. Even the ones who are, you know, it's only those really who were quite young.
Sure, children.
Who are still around. Yeah.
But is this a touchstone for you in a way? I mean, this period of history or that place of history?
Yeah, overall, I mean, World War II was unquestionably the dominant narrative of it has been the dominant narrative of my life, maybe up until fairly recently, in the sense that, you know, with the end of the Cold War, to me, the Cold War is really still just World War II. It's World War II being continued in different and by a different means, with some alterations in who's on whose side and so on. But, you know, it was always clear that as a kid to me that the Cold War was in some ways an extension of what had happened in the Second World War or a response to that. So, you know, in the social realm, in the political realm, in the world of popular culture and entertainment, the Second World War was ubiquitous. I couldn't escape it. It was on TV. It was in the movies. It was on the news. The space race. You know, and that's even before I knew just how much the U.S. space program had been formed by grafting it onto the Nazi roots of the V2 rocket program and Wernher von Braun. So, you know, it's inescapable for me. It always has been, but it's also fantastically interesting to me too. And I never tire of, you know, any kind of new World War II film that comes along or anything set having to do with the Holocaust or espionage during World War II or the home front story, anything that's like something I will check out and look at before anything else.
Well, Wernher von Braun figures a lot in this novel, mm-hmm. which got me thinking about Tom Lehrer's song. About mm-hmm. Wernher von Braun, and I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you write about him and you're here to just listen to Tom Lehrer's song about Wernher von Braun.
Gather round while I sing you of Wernher von Braun, a man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience. Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Wernher von Braun. Don't say that he's hypocritical. Say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun.
So that's a little glimpse of Tom Lehrer. Mm-hmm. You write, and I'm looking at a picture that you have of Wernher von Braun. This guy, he was a monster, but look at him, defeated as a prisoner. And you go on to describe mm-hmm. this particular photograph.
Right, it's the day of his surrender, when he surrendered to the Allies, right at the very, very end of the Second World War, and mm-hmm. and this famous photo, he had broken his arm sometime shortly before. His arm's in this immense plaster cast. And this ought to be the low point, or certainly a low point of his life. And he just has this amazing, smug cat that ate the canary expression on his face, as if he's foreseeing the fact that in a very short period of time, he will be lionized as an American hero of science and technology, the man who put a man on the moon. And, you know, it's a remarkable story. He was a remarkable person. There's no doubt about it. He was also unquestionably deeply complicit with horrifying crimes against humanity.
You've also done some writing for movies, including Spider-Man 2. Mm-hmm. John Carter, did you do that mm-hmm. one too?
Yes,
you
I
kind
did.
Kind of grimaced when you said that.
I mean, only I'm proud of the movie, but it's a legendary flop at this point. It's mentioned in the same breath as movies like Heaven's Gate and Ishtar. Geez. So, you know, I can't help but when the name comes up, I don't understand. I thought it was a pretty good movie myself.
Do you like writing for movies? It must be different.
It depends on the collaborators. And when you have amazing, talented people to work with, as I did in both the cases you mentioned, you know, it can be fun. The collaboration can be fun. The first draft of writing a script is usually pretty absorbing and interesting work. It's when you get into the endless cycles of notes from the studio and revisions and more notes and then you get into this part where you're still working on it, but you sense usually correctly that it's never going to get made and that the people who would be writing the checks have lost interest in the project, and yet for some reason the writer's always the last one to know.
Yeah,
you know, they just haven't taken it out and shot it, and you kind of wish they would. And you know, those parts of it can be not so fun. But on the other hand, it's pretty remunerative. So I console myself with money.
I read, and you can correct me, but we're going to play the music anyway, that while writing this book, you did listen to Benny Goodman, Moonglow?
Yeah, the Benny Goodman quartet version of Moonglow. I played it within a couple of days of starting the book to set the mood for me. I just realized I wanted the experience of reading the novel to feel like the experience of listening to this
wow.
track. And so to ensure that happened, I decided to call the book Moonglow and try to get it to fit somehow.
It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, for me too.
Michael Chabon,
you're the best.
Thank you so much. Michael Chabon, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And yes, that is the Benny Goodman Quartet, his song Moonglow, which also happens to be the title of Michael Chabon's new book. He's also the author of a bunch of other ones, including The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
Very
Times.
Very much my pleasure.
Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.